everyone. The Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue is open. We are going to go through our agenda in reverse order today and open up a work session on Senate Bill 1528 for a couple reasons, one of which is to update you on a new amendment to look at on that bill that has the disconnect mechanisms from the federal pass-throughs. And so here is Chris Alanek.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So there are two amendments in OLS right now, 1528-5, which is just a revised version of what you saw on Tuesday. And in the dash 7, the only difference from the dash 5 is that instead of the personal income tax rate cut going from the 5 and 7 to the 4 and 6, is an increase in the personal exemption credit. And that is in section 16 of the bill. It's basically a $50 increase in the personal exemption credit. There is a technical problem with the number that's in there, so we're working on a new amendment. We expect to get that any minute this morning. And it has to do with inflation adjustment factors and so forth. The number that got put in there isn't correct. It's supposed to be a $50 increase in current dollars in 2018. So otherwise, it's the same amendment where the first few sections relate to the Oregon Opportunity Grant Tax Credit, capped at $14 million. There were just some technical changes there for HEC. And then in sections, beginning section 12, are the changes to the Oregon pass-through policy. And in section 10 is the federal disconnect. All of that's the same from what you heard the other day. The only change is the exemption credit.
So the difference between the two, instead of reducing the income tax rates from 4 to 6, I'm going to put the credit. What's the significance of that?
The tax credit, the personal exemption credit right now is about $200 per person. So if you have a family of four, they get four exemption credits. So that's $800 in tax credits. In Oregon law, that credit is capped for single filers at $100,000 of income and for joint filers at $200,000 of income. So once filers hit that income level, those higher income taxpayers don't get the personal exemption credit. And part of the connection, or the nexus, if you will, with the changes in the federal level is the personal exemption deduction at the federal level was eliminated. And at the federal level, it's about a $4,000 deduction. And again, the deduction is pre-tax dollars. So it was taken away at the federal level, and part of what the dash 7 does is increase the Oregon exemption credit. And again, it's limited to filers under those income thresholds.
Just makes it a little more targeted toward lower and middle income than the 4 and 6 reduction.
Right, the 4 and 6 reduction in the rates, that would affect every taxpayer because those are marginal rates, so every taxpayer would have a tax cut from those. Here, it's targeted to the folks up to $100,000 or $200,000 of income.
Senator Buffer, did you have a question?
Yes. Please, if you would, Mr. Chair. Chris, so just to recap before I phrase my question to understand, is that we're eliminating the concept of moving a rate from 5 to 4 and from 6, or from 7 to 6, and replacing it with a $50 increase, right?
In the exemption credit,
Exemption credit. In the chart that you previously provided us, the value of the 5 to 4, 7 to 6 was roughly $200 million on the chart, at this chart right here from LRO, put on that screen in the committee hearing. By replacing that with the new concept that is more targeted, what is that number?
Kyle has more exact numbers, but roughly speaking, that $200 million referred to, it's a one-year 2018 tax cut, and that falls to about between $140 and $150 million for that one year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so that's an amendment that's out there too. Although it sounds like it needs a couple technical changes.
Quite literally one number needs to change. The number that's in here in that section is the 90 is being replaced with 140. that 140 actually needs to be something like 110 or 115.
Okay.
And it has to do with, because those are inflation-adjusted numbers. Everything pegs back to a base year, and they get adjusted every year.
All right. So we'll have that cleaned-up amendment ready to go for tomorrow.
Where LC is working on it right now, we expect to receive it before the committee meeting is done today.
And the other amendment, should we choose to do that, is ready to go.
Yes.
Okay. Anything else on 1528?
Those are the conceptuals. I don't know if you wanted to go through detailed revenue numbers yet or if you wanted to wait till later.
We'll wait till later.
Okay.
Okay. And we do have some, we have a couple of people who got skipped over when we were taking witnesses on the other day on 1528. So they're here today, Chris Allman and Jordan Sheldon. If you could come up briefly for your time. And also in the category of witnesses, there was a testimony submitted by the Tax Foundation specific to Oregon speaking in favor. It's on OLAS. But essentially supporting the disconnect from the federal pass-through provision. So welcome, Jordan.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Jordan Sheldon. I grew up in Portland primarily. I moved around a lot due to economic circumstances in my childhood. As a result, grew up very acutely aware of how the income inequality in Portland affects different groups. And despite that, I ended up dropping out of high school just because maintaining the different standards throughout high school is like, oof. Just different standards throughout high schools moving around was very not great. Like, sorry, first time testifying, nerves.
It's okay.
I'm fine with this. Despite having to drop out due to this, I got my GED, and through Pell Grant, I have been able to go to college. I'm currently a poli-sci major at PCC. I appreciate the chance to come and testify, and I am here on behalf of the 675 members of the Portland Democratic Socialists of America. On Tuesday, we came through to give testimony about the federal and state pass-through that disproportionately benefit the wealthiest businesses. Instead, it was fairly inaccessible. There was amendment changes that we were not made aware of. We ended up signing up to testify for the wrong bill because of this. It was fairly obtuse legislative process that didn't seem designed for average people to come in and give their opinions and be involved in the legislative process. This was confusing for DSA members and for Multnomah County Democrats as well, and other grassroots organizations that may have wanted to weigh in on this legislation. I appreciate the administrators of this committee for giving us this chance, and as well, like, just keeping us informed. DSA's vision is one of humane policies that serve people. And we believe that wealth must be distributed to support services, education, infrastructure, and the overall needs of Oregon residents. We want Oregon lawmakers to both disconnect from the IRS, from the Internal Revenue Code, and to eliminate the lower tax brackets for pass-through businesses passed in 2013. This would save nearly $300 million a year. For too long, our legislature has based our tax policies on the advice and counsel of paid lobbyists. These special interests have ensured our economy stays rigged and our public institutions thus suffer from perpetual austerity. It is time to begin to rectify our rigged system. We would, it is time to implement legislation that benefits the people, that funds education, healthcare, our foster care system, infrastructure, transportation, housing, and all of the underfunded programs that have been sorely ignored, so that the wealthy and corporations get the tax breaks that, so that the wealthy and corporations don't get the tax breaks they don't need. You will hear that businesses will suffer, that businesses will leave. We say it's time to tend to the interest of people in this state, the people that were that you were elected to represent. It's time for you, our legislators, to start working to support a tax system that benefits our state, our families, our seniors, and our students like me. It's time to begin the process to unrig this broken tax structure, and I can tell you right now that if you want higher levels of economic activity, revenue stability, and upward mobility, then giving money to those who are already in a position of comfort and security isn't going to achieve these goals. People say we just need to teach civics in school to get more people to vote, but the lesson people learn time and time again is politicians have a lot of empty promises. I can assure you that you will be seeing a lot more of DSA members eager to participate in writing legislative concepts, tracking bills, and lobbying for progressive legislation. That's the takeaway of my civics lesson this week. Please help you make Oregon a state where we work towards the common good of all Oregonians.
Thank you. Good job. Okay. Question to Jordan.
No, thank you.
Chair Haas and members of the committee, I wasn't prepared to speak today, but I'm not going to say a whole lot other than to reiterate some of the points that Jordan has just made. I'm coming from a 15-year history of activism where I've known Senator Haas that length of time and where I share your vision of what we need to do to have adequate and stable funding so that we can get young men like Jordan to be able to transgress into and make headway into a class that helps him feel comfortable in raising, getting married, having children, living a middle-class life. So he's on track, and that's partly because we've got means to help him get tuition breaks, and he's dedicated and wants to be involved. And so this is the kind of thing that gives me hope. But we do need revenue. We need to make sure that we're bringing in more revenue and making sure that as we think about the breaks that we are going to have in the tax structure with these proposed amendments, these are really important. So I applaud your efforts to do what we need to disconnect from the Internal Revenue Code in terms of the small business pass-through. And I hope it is in your power to remove these special rates for businesses that are not creating jobs, that are getting paying taxes less than individuals for no good reason. So thank you. I appreciate this opportunity to talk.
Thank you. Thank you both. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1528, and we are going to open up public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 1529. This is the repatriation measure. And we will go for a walkthrough with Kyle. This is also part of the federal tax bill, and it has ramifications on our state.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Senate Bill 1529, we do have the -4 amendment, which has the portion related to repatriation. But and so Chris and I will be, I guess, sharing this bill in some of the discussion. But the underlying bill, before we get into the -4, has to do with the Oregon's connection to federal tax statutes. So you can almost think of Oregon's connection in two brackets or two buckets, if you will. You have the rolling reconnect, which connects Oregon to the definition of taxable income. And then you have the second piece, which is the bill that comes before you annually, where there it's an actual tie-in statute that points to a specific date. And so that has to be updated each year to continue that tie. So we'll generally tie to December 31st of the prior year, just to capture any of the changes that are made at the federal level. What's up there on the screen is a breakdown or a table showing each section of the bill and what statute it points to, and then what's the general topic of what it is you're tying to. for the most part, the changes that Chris has talked about during the interim and then also been part of the discussion, such as the pass-through deduction that was created by the feds and those such things, come through the definition of taxable income. So that's not what Senate Bill 1529 is specifically about. These are about the pointed statutes to each go into that December 31st statute or that date. So many of the things contained in here are really technical updates for the most part. There's one thing to highlight, and it's in the first section, is the Oregon 529 College Savings Network. This is discussion. It's working its way through legislation on the House side, but there were changes at the federal level as part of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, allowing what the 529 right now is a savings plan for higher education. The changes at the federal level are allowing those expenses, or allowing some of the expenses up to $10,000 per year, to be used for K through 12 private education or public education. So that's a change. There's ongoing discussion in how Oregon connects to that. We could have constitutional issues there. So it's just something to flag as there is a potential change going forward right now in a House bill that this committee could potentially see if it makes its way over.
On that note, sorry for interrupting, but the House is working on how to integrate that bill. So we're not going to deal with that sort of nuance of the federal change in this bill. So. But this bill is written in a way that's not going to conflict with whatever the House does on that.
No, Mr. Chair, I think we will probably be okay because we're looking at doing an add back here in Oregon, so we'd still have to connect to that date just to keep the 529 program protected as it has to conform with federal law, and then we'll just be adding back, potentially adding back as needed anything we disconnect from. So
right,
we
thanks.
Disallow those cases. Well. But yeah, and I just wanted to flag it so the committee's aware that is in a different bill on the other chamber right now. So that's the underlying connection piece. And I know we have the CPAs as well. They'll be walking through their presentation as well and some of the individual components.
So that's the connection piece. And then Chris is going to talk about the actual underlying, the gist of this bill, the goal, the intent of the federal government was to get these giant companies who have been keeping money offshore to move it back, and I'll let you take it from there.
Okay. Yeah. Chris.
First of Kyle's presentation.
Sarah Boklis.
Could you just clarify? So everything that's on this sheet, that thing that's up there, are basically just the reconnect issues.
Yes.
Okay. Got it. Thank you.
So, for the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. So the issue the chair is referring to is the repatriation. These are the foreign earnings going back to 1986 that have not been taxed by the U.S. They're going to be deemed repatriated, and the CPAs will be able to get into a lot more detail. So, but this is just a very high level example to hopefully provide some framework for that. And so with that money coming back to the U.S., the original thought was that there would be a bump in Oregon tax in federal taxable income, and then Oregon would see a bump in revenues due to that. But due to a technical nature related to these things called dividend received deductions, Oregon actually isn't tied to that, and it results in a revenue loss. So that's what the example is basically about. So what we have here with this little picture is you have Corporation A owns Corporation B, and when Corporation B makes a profit and they pay taxes, and after those profits are paid, they pay out dividends, and some of those dividends will come back to Corporation A. So Corporation A is the U.S. company, Corporation B is the foreign company, and that's the flow of this income, or these dividends, are what we're talking about. And the idea is that these dividends paid out of Corporation B are after Corporation B has paid tax on that income. So when Corporation A files their taxes, they are allowed to deduct these dividends, because they had the concept there is that they had been taxed under through the other corporation. So federal law allows a 100% dividend deduction. Now, that's the general policy. The way that the feds have implemented this repatriation situation is pretty complicated. The repatriated dollars coming back are going to be taxed at either 8% or 15%. But to arrive at that, there's some complicated math about the amount that actually will show up on the 2017 return because that 2017 return has a 35% tax rate. So just conceptually, Corporation A receives $1 million of these deemed dividends. And this is the $1 million that gets taxed at either the 8 or the 15%. But they calculate a deduction, and in this example, their deduction is $750,000 to arrive at $250,000. Now, the reason for that is the $250,000 that will be showing up in their federal taxable income will be taxed at a rate of 35%. And so that tax amount is such that is identical to the $1 million being taxed at a combination of 8% and 15%. So corporations will go through this calculation. They'll say, okay, we have $1 million of this income, and let's just say it's taxed all at 15%. So that is their tax liability on that $1 million. But then they have to figure out how much income will be taxed at 35% to arrive at that same number. And then that's how they get their deduction, because the $1 million is taxed at 15%, the $250,000 is taxed at 35%, and those two numbers need to be equal. So each corporation will have to calculate their own dividend received deduction. And I didn't lay out all of that math. It's pretty convoluted and complicated, not relevant to the Oregon issue per se. The concept is they get this deduction of $750,000. And they'll be paying tax on the $250,000. Oregon will see this bump in the $250,000 because we're tied to that amount. Under normal law, without this quirk in our current law, when they go to calculate their Oregon tax return, they would add back their federal dividend received deductions, these DRDs. Because Oregon historically has disconnected from the federal deduction policy, we have our own deduction policy. So basically, when corporations get this federal deduction, they have to add that back on the Oregon return, and then they get the Oregon deduction. So the problem is that there's no add back under current law. They still get the $800,000 deduction, which is 80% of the $1 million, and they arrive at this net loss position. And that's where we are under. This is the double deduction. By doing this, they get both the federal deduction and the Oregon deduction. The fix in the dash 4, the 1529, is the same scenario. They have the $1 million of income, they get the federal deduction of $750,000, and their taxable income increases by $250,000. Then on the Oregon return, they have to add back that $750,000 deduction to pull in that full $1 million, and then they get an 80% deduction off their on their Oregon return, which is $800,000. It's 80% of the $1 million. So in net, they will be paying tax on $200,000 more of Oregon income. And so this is simply the problem. This add back provision in law doesn't point to the right place in the Internal Revenue Code. It doesn't pick up this new federal deduction. Oregon statute hadn't conceived of this deduction because it didn't exist before. The feds created it with this repatriation. They placed it in one point in the IRC, and our statute doesn't point to it. So what the dash 4 does is it points to that part of the Internal Revenue Code and says, no, you have to add back that deduction. And that takes us from a revenue loss position to a revenue gain. The revenue loss position is very counterintuitive, and it's not consistent with existing policy for other dividends. So I still don't know if that makes any sense. I mean, every time I walk through this, I'm not sure it makes sense. But the key theme there are these deductions. The feds allow this deduction, and Oregon has its own policy. And to get the Oregon deduction, you have to add back. You don't get the federal deduction. You have to add it back. But because of the way current law is written, corporations are getting both the federal deduction and the Oregon deduction.
And if we did nothing, how would this play out?
If we did nothing, we're looking at a revenue loss this biennium of about $100 million related to this provision. And with the fix, we go from a revenue loss position of $100 million to a revenue gain position of about $160 million, depending on the interaction with the tax haven piece. And that's another part of the Dash 4 amendment, is a repeal of the tax haven law. And it allows a credit against these repatriation tax of the tax haven tax. And the policy justification for that is the state since 2014 has had this tax haven tax, if you will, to use some shorthand, to precisely get at these dollars that are being kept overseas. But with the repatriation, all of those dollars are being pulled into the tax system. So the idea is that the tax haven dollars paid are a subset of the repatriation dollars. So then there's a credit against the repatriation dollars for any corporations who had paid the tax haven tax, if you will.
Senator Boquist, do you have a question?
Not quite yet, Mr. Chair. But I do want to thank LRO because this isn't a moving target. This is 12 different moving targets and one, three initials. Because just for the record, so everybody understands, I reiterate what I said previously several days ago, is these numbers change on a hour-by-hour notice now simply because of all the dynamics. And Chris, I think the one thing that would be helpful before, I guess we're going to move on to testimony of people who think they understand this as well as Chris does, which none of us think we know we understand it at all, is that how complex these real numbers are. I mean, this is because of our single sales. We don't know what's going to be apportioned to Oregon, what's not going to be apportioned to Oregon, and it could be a minus $100 million if it's aligned with the blue moon, or it could be plus 160. We don't really know, do we?
Chair House, Senator, or Vice Chair Boquist, to that point, it is hard to quantify the uncertainty here, but this has been in law now for 5 or 6 weeks, and there still are a lot of questions and anticipation of what the IRS regs are going to be on these situations, as well as perhaps a fixed bill by Congress. And one of the themes that you're going to take away from the CPA's testimony is the uncertainty about how all of this plays out and how it specifically plays out. So there are assumptions. We've been talking with stakeholders for several weeks, CPAs, tax lawyers, about what is, and LC, to obviously legislative counsel, what is the most likely interpretation of the law and how it will be implemented. But if there were ever a way to quantify and put a number on uncertainty, it would be nice to use that here. Because of that federal landscape, it's a new law, and we're still waiting for the guidance on the IRS because it's federal law.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Hass. So I was tracking what you were saying, and the part where I need additional clarification is with the two footnotes. So on line two, you have the assume 10% cash, 90% non-cash. So I just wanted you to talk me through that. And then the footnote, I'm sorry to get into this, but that could really impact the potential calculation. And then the assumes 20% ownership. I just was wondering if you could please explain those two things, because those seem to be would throw the whole thing.
There are, Chair Hass, Senator Taylor, those are largely for CPAs and tax lawyers who are aware of the nuts and bolts, because they do play into this. Now, the 10% cash and the 90% cash play into the $1 million.
Yeah.
So I'm Corporation A, and I have this $1 million.
Yeah.
And I mentioned that there are two tax rates, 8% and 15, or 15.5 to be exact, mm-hmm. 8% and 15% tax rates. My cash, if that $1 million, depending on what that consists of, if it's cash, it gets taxed at 15.5%. If it's a non-cash asset, then it gets taxed, or an illiquid asset, it gets taxed at 8%.
So won't people, I'm sorry, follow up. Won't people be motivated then to change that dynamic to have it be more favorable to them?
Well, it'll be as of a point in time in the federal law.
But if you had a large amount of money, I mean.
But yes, it's a point in the past.
Okay. Oh, it already occurred. Can't change that. Okay. So couldn't go on. Okay.
And so how I did that was, this is getting into the math that I didn't include on here, but the $1 million, 10% of it is cash. So that $100,000 is taxed at 15%.
Mm-hmm.
And $900,000 is taxed at 8%.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that gets me to a number.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now that is the tax that the corporation owes on the $1 million. This all shows up on their 2017 tax return, and that my income on the 2017 return is going to be taxed at 35%. So the question for me as a corporation is, I need to adjust down this $1 million to some number such that when it's taxed at 35%, I get to the same tax liability of the $1 million at the combination of 8% and 15%. And so what that tells me, if I were to play out the arithmetic, that would tell me that I need to tax $250,000 at 35%, gets me to the same number as $100,000 at 8% and 50%. And so once I figure out the 250, then I know my deduction is $750,000. So I take from my million, I deduct $750,000. This is all federal level. And I will be taxed, my $250,000 gets taxed at 35%. And then that gets me, that's a very roundabout way to get at the math.
Okay, and then the 20% ownership?
The baseline deduction, Oregon deduction is, the feds have a 100% deduction in general law, not here. Oregon has a 70% deduction or an 80% deduction, depending on the amount of ownership.
Okay.
And so that footnote right there is why I'm using 80% right here instead of, say, 70%.
Okay.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Boquist.
Let me take another stab at it and not let then Chris, try and put the economists in there to try and explain this in a so everybody sort of gets a better understanding. Unfortunately, Madam Senator, I've been dealing with this for the last 3 weeks and now I have completely mucked up mine, but it could actually be sort of simplified. My understanding, and I just for the record, do agree we need to fix this. It's how and when and what we do with it. The federal law, in a nutshell, repeals the 1986 law. So people were keeping, C corporations, mm-hmm. were keeping this $1 million offshore. Since that time, in this particular thing right here, some of them decided to take $900,000 of that money and invested it in equipment in someplace overseas. So they've got it on their tax return already, and it's already being booked, and these CPAs can talk about this. And then on December 31st of this last year, we just flat changed the law. It says 86 is gone. You now owe your taxes on this. And so part of it in this scenario, 90% of that that's up here, in just an example, the 90% is in some sort of equipment or investment they did over there, and 10% is in cash. And then they came up with a rather interesting, convoluted way of, as Chris did accurately explain for those people who could follow it, is that you have to adjust. I was going to use the word manipulate because I think it's a better word, but you have to adjust this stuff to make this combination that's going on. Then, of course, in 2004, Oregon did change its law in a version to try and encourage people to bring money back. And of course, our law just is an anomaly in the other 50 states that's out there. And I'm trying to look at this for a perspective, which I would encourage people not to change because, again, we really need to do something here. It's how, when, and what we do. Is that, okay, Oregon, for some bizarre reason, you were here, 2004, right? Made this 2004 law, which was trying to encourage people to bring money back. Why anybody bringing it back with the federal law the way it was? Maybe we anticipated. And now we've made a law change, the 2004 law. In all the research that I've done, all the conversations I've had, and there's people in the diocese here that have had these conversations with people, there is no one good explanation other than it's mucked up. Okay? That's the best explanation. I haven't had a single person who would pay either of these columns come forward and say, hey, we know what this does and we're going to do X, Y, Z. It's just plain mucked up. And so we do need to fix it. The question is how we fix it. It is one-time income and how we kind of proceed forward. So that's why I asked the questions about, it's very hard to value this, even though it's booked at the IRS level effective December 31st, 2017, how that translates for Company X that might be a billion-dollar corporation here in Oregon, we certainly do not know. So, am I sort of close to it in layman's terms? I don't want you to muck this up with economic things because it's too hard to understand.
No economics. In 2004-05, I guess just a clarification, it was under the Bush administration, it was a couple of things that are relevant here is the prior law, it was a voluntary repatriation. So corporations, if they chose to bring money back to the U.S.,
okay.
then And so two things. It was voluntary. It was federal policy. It was voluntary. And the corporations had to bring the money back to the U.S. And so there, that policy happened there. It did cause a similar problem for Oregon back then. And the 05 legislature fixed that in a similar way to say you only get one deduction. But that fix in Oregon law was sunset because back then this was viewed as a one-time thing at the federal level. So there wasn't a permanent policy put in place by the legislature. So the Oregon fix sunset. Two big differences now is that the repatriation dollars don't have to come back to the U.S. They are just going to be it's called deemed repatriated or deemed dividends. The IRS feels that they know where this money is, and it's the corporations will have to add it to their tax return to be taxed. They don't actually have to bring it back to the U.S., but it will be taxed. And the reason for that, and you'll hear more detail on this later, is that the U.S. is moving from what's called a worldwide system to a territorial system. And I touched on some of this on the presentation back in January. It's a major shift in the tax legislation. One of the ways, the main concept there is under a worldwide system, if you're a U.S. resident company, we're going to tax all of your income. The U.S. is going to tax all of your income. But we had this deferral system for foreign earnings. Under the territorial system, we don't care about the foreign earnings. We're just going to tax the U.S. income. That, in turn, has implications for the relevancy of the tax haven law. So that's part of the reason for the repeal and the Dash amendments, is that under the U.S. territorial system, which began 1/1/18, and we're still figuring out how that's going to play out, to the vice chair's point. It will be a while. But whether or not a tax haven law makes sense under a territorial system, it arguably just doesn't work and it doesn't make sense. So that's also part of the reason, the policy reason for the repeal there.
Did you want to speak to the rainy day fund?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So the other piece in there is acknowledging that it is one-time revenue. So the money, rather than going into the general fund and getting mixed in with the structural spending, if you will, it's being put into the rainy day fund for a couple of reasons. It is one-time revenue, and again, getting back to the uncertainty of the amount of the revenue and the estimates. We're doing the best we can with the estimates, with the information we have available. We have, at the federal level, there's been information about how much money is going to be coming back or going to be taxed. And the starting point for that is $2.5 trillion to $3 trillion is going to show up on federal tax rolls. Now, the impact on Oregon really is how much of that money is the two key questions are which companies are going to be affected by that, and then to what extent do those companies have an Oregon footprint? So there is a lot of uncertainty given the one-time nature and the uncertainty of the estimate. The idea is to put it into the rainy day fund rather than to spend it before it may not materialize, if you will.
Chris, I know you put a lot of time into this, and you've done some due diligence speaking to some of the larger companies that pay taxes here about this and attorneys, and I know that a lot of them are confident in your fix here, and it's an important fix, swinging from negative $100 million to potentially a positive $160 million. So thank you for your research here. I know it didn't start yesterday. It started months ago. We do have some people we want to hear from on this issue. So why don't I call up Nikki Dubay from COST?
Good morning, Chairman Haas, members of the committee. Nikki Dubay with the Council on State Taxation. Very happy to be here today to support a bill in Oregon. It's always exciting when I get to go and be in support of something, because a lot of what I do is oppose. So I'm woefully behind. I'm working off of the Dash 2 amendments. Just saw the Dash 4 amendments this morning. Don't believe that our comments will change, but we will definitely resubmit written comments if they do. Specifically, my comments are directed towards the repeal of tax haven legislation and the 2017 credit for those tax haven dollars or dollars taxes paid on tax haven income. COST believes this is based in sound tax policy and moves Oregon in the right direction for its business climate. So I've been in contact with Chris at Legislative Revenue Office about the credit. We believe that it needs to be, there needs to be some additional drafting done, that there could be some potential issues with just the way that it's currently drafted, but we are fully in support of what we believe the committee's intent to be, which is a dollar for dollar credit for any tax paid on prior tax haven income. So again, I just want to say thank you. I'm happy to get into the weeds if you'd like, but there's no need to get into the messy details. We would like to be a resource to help with that credit, and just want to commend the committee for the work on this issue.
Senator Buckley. I think one of the issues on tax haven dollar for dollar was it dollar for dollar of what they were taxed, or dollar for dollar for what they should have been taxed? Dollar for dollar what they paid versus dollar for dollar with the tax rate. So,
right. My understanding is the intent is that it will be dollar for dollar for what they actually paid, based on any increased income from tax haven, from a tax haven entity that was added back. That doesn't line up apples to apples with the way the repatriation will come in for various reasons, and that can depend from taxpayer to taxpayer on several facts and circumstances. So we just want to ensure that those dollars aren't going to be double taxed, which is precluded under the tax haven legislation itself. So there will definitely need to be some unraveling. We think this will be more of a burden on corporations that have paid the tax to figure that out. But we just want to make sure that, that credit works the way the committee intends.
Thank you for coming down and for your help on this.
Okay, thank you.
We do have some CPAs we'd like to call forward. Gary Holcomb, Heather Jackson. You're taking a neutral third-party position here on the policy, but
yes.
You do have some insights on how this will be executed.
Certainly. Good morning, Chair Haas and members of the committee. My name is Gary Holcomb. I'm an executive director in the state and local tax practice of Ernst & Young. I'm here on behalf of the 4,400 members of the Oregon Society of CPAs.
Good morning, Chair Senator Haas and committee members. I am Heather Jackson with Duo Conradi. I am also here representing the Oregon Society of CPAs.
Chair Haas, as you mentioned, we'll get into the reconnect. But as you mentioned, we're not here in support or not. We're here to help you try to understand it, you and the committee members. As we testified on Tuesday, there's a number of things that are different this year than what we've done. The first thing on our agenda was to walk through some of the regular disconnect provisions. Is that something you'd still like us to do, or would you like us to jump into?
I think we're there.
Okay, so just concentrate on the territorial worldwide.
Please.
Okay. If we can get to maybe slide 80 within the presentation, I think that might be the...
We're there,
I'm
Mr.
so
Chair.
Glad I said that.
Mr. Chair, we're there. There's 80 pages of detail, but we're there. Okay, I'm just where we're going.
I didn't know we were that smart.
So within the international provisions that were changed as part of the 2017 Act, there were hundreds of provisions that affect the international. I think there were three key areas that our clients are worrying about, and those are this transition tax, which you just talked about, the global intangible low-taxed income, GILTI, and the foreign-derived intangible income, the FDII. And those are ongoing issues, and then the BEAT, the base erosion and anti-abuse tax. And those are three really relevant things, so I'm going to walk through those three items and hopefully give you a little bit of clarification. On slide 81, if we look at what's happening, what we've talked about this morning, I'll talk about second, and that's the repatriation. But I think it's very important to understand what's going to be happening in the future. So there's this one-time repatriation event, but for any distribution made after 2017, so it's tax year 2018, that is going to come back as income into the United States, so it's actual distributions, that is going to be allowed 100% deduction. And as Chris explained, right, that's to get us from a worldwide system where we tax all worldwide income to just that income earned in the United States. So that income now has been already taxed in that foreign country, and so instead of having foreign tax credits and mechanisms that we currently have, it's not going to be taxed at all by the United States. Okay. What gets complicated is what do we do to get us to that going forward system in 2018? What the Congress decided to do was to do this one-time repatriation. So from 1986 to current, they are deeming this as a dividend. It's not an actual dividend. You may bring back, you've seen things in the press where people are paying tax on $167 billion of earnings, but they're only bringing back $50 billion. And part of it, I think, Senator Taylor, it gets to your earlier question, is people have plant and equipment. This is not all abusive tax avoidance income. This is legitimate. This is everything that every company does in a foreign jurisdiction, all the money they've earned. So that, as you said, Senator Boquist, they've invested in plants, they've invested in people overseas. They're not bringing that back. They can't bring that back. And that was the reason why there's these two different rates that you were mentioning earlier. It's 15.5% on cash that's sitting overseas, but it's only 9% on the property, plant, and equipment and other items that are sitting overseas. So that will all come back. That is a one-time event. It all comes back. It's a one-time calculation that will happen. They pay tax on that, and that's not considered within this legislation, and it would be a policy choice for you to make. They can either, because of that significant hit, and especially if it's based on property, plant, and equipment, for federal purposes, they can choose to pay that over 5 years instead of all at once because of the burden that it may create.
Senator Boquist.
I just want to make sure I understand, because previously we've been told it was over 8 years.
It is eight years. You're right. Correct. Not 5 years, 8 years.
I was just trying to say, okay, we're even more complex, and we found another line.
No, it is. It is 8 years for federal purposes.
I think I had the same thought.
Yep. Chris's job does explain the way the Oregon provision works, and again, it's an interpretation. It's probably the leading interpretation the way he explained it, but because no one's certain of how this will actually be treated for federal purposes, that's why it's the leading interpretation. The reason I put on page 83 the slide of how the federal tax return works is it helps explain just it comes in as a dividend up here on line 4, right? And then you take it on line 29B as a special deduction. So you have line 20, the way the tax return works is you're a line 28 state or a line 30 state. And Oregon's really a line 30 state, adds back all the dividends, and then takes the deduction again. So that's how we ended up in this spot. That really only works if the IRS treats it this way. Right? And we'll talk about this a little bit under the guilty fitty provisions. An interpretation when this first came out was that they were just going to net those two all up above. So instead of taking the $1 million inclusion and the $750 deduction that Chris mentioned, you net it out up above and only include $250 in income. So that's why I mentioned it's the leading interpretation the way Chris had, but the IRS has not issued specific guidance yet about that they're not going to use the netting process.
I have a question.
Senator Burchard.
Has the IRS are the rules out yet even on this stuff?
Absolutely not. Later testimony, if we get there, will include. Regulations, as you know, are subject to public hearing and open policy, so that will take a significant period of time. And what that means, no one knows. They've issued several notices, but that's it. And they will likely be notices, right? So those are opinions issued by, you know, where they're directionally headed.
So how are you going to prepare these taxes without having the rules?
There's a lot of minds across the country thinking about this right now.
Wonderful.
And just as an aside, most people have already made a lot of decisions on these things because they've issued their earnings releases and made their financial statements. So they've already made a lot of these. They had to make these decisions within the month of January. So on slide 84, the purpose of slide 84 is it was considerations that we're seeing across the country that states are having to take into account. I think you've covered several of these, especially the first two about ownership percentages and how the wording of the statutes think. Speaking with the DOR, this is probably the case, but there's also some netting issues here. If you think about what happens, and we need to make sure that we're clear, is from a federal perspective, if you earned $100 in Germany and lost $50 in Japan, coming back, it's $50, right?
So you reconcile before you come. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you net before you bring it back, and you get to take all that into account. I've made money here, lost money there. You net that. There's a confusion in a number of states if they're going to allow that netting process and follow that rule from the IRS. The other one that's listed, one of the ones that's listed here, I think it's bullet point four, is whether all this income is in the factor. So what we've been talking about this morning is just, is it in income? So once it's in income, then we have to apportion it to Oregon. And if we now have that $250 number that is included in Chris's example, does that go in the numerator and the denominator of the Oregon apportionment? And this legislation does not answer that question, so it's something for you all to consider on that. Tax haven was, I think, when this was prepared, the tax haven was a large consideration, and I you know, now you proposed several answers. I was going to move on to the guilty fitty provisions now. Again, this is for all years after. So this is to help. You're already bringing back your money every year from foreign. We're not dealing with any of that. What Congress has now established, and you'll hear this term a lot, is a carrot and a stick provision. So this is kind of fictional, right? This isn't different types of income. You've already doing these activities. But what they're saying is, if it's globally guilty, I won't try to say those five words every time. If it's guilty income, what they're saying is you now have to include this in your tax income, you include this amount. And that's to encourage, those are payments that are made out to foreign countries that you have to include those in. I'm sorry, the reverse. They're from foreign countries into the U.S. You now include those in your income. The carrot piece of it is FDII income, and that's for payments paid out of from payments out to in the United States, trying to encourage that activity, because now that's giving activity within the United States, right? It's encouraging that type of income. So you go through this complicated calculation between these two, and the slides you left earlier on. We have a slide deck within our firm that's over 100 pages that tells you nothing but how to calculate FDII. So very, very complex calculations to get to these numbers. But it is a carrot and a stick, and this is going to have to be a calculation going forward all the time. So this also is going to, these are all new provisions, and these are also going to have to be taken into account, just like what you did with the repatriation provisions. Do the IRS sections line up correctly with the way that you would like to be taxed? So again, is it going to be all netted up above as a deduction? Is it going to be some deduction and inclusion of income? Is it going to be a dividend down below? There's also subpart F and Section 78 gross up within this. So Oregon is going to need to either tie or purposely disconnect from a lot of these provisions. And similar to the 965, you'll see within here things like 951 Cap A. That's a totally new provision. So under our regular reconnect, we'd automatically be connected because we're adopting that. Do you want to be connected to those provisions? But about a lot of the same concerns as I mentioned earlier, because it's calculated so similarly on a return about tax havens, because there will need to be tax havens need to be addressed for these provisions going forward too, because it could be some of the same income. The last area that we look at is this anti-base erosion provision. I'm sorry.
Senator Buckwith.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify for the people who aren't tracking that GILTI and FDII are cute little acronyms from the federal government. I've already had people contact my offices. Well, they created the GILTI provision because these people are guilty or something. So just for the record here, GILTI and FDII are acronyms which state what this is. It's kind of cute. I think some of us laughed on a conference call of saying, okay, you're guilty. What's this? And so just for the public, I mean, these are acronyms, and if they really want to see what they are, they can go to OLIS and see the full written definition. So I don't want anybody confused out there, because I've already seen emails on this that, you know, misrepresent the situation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, absolutely correct. The BEAT provisions are a new tax that will also come in within 2018, and these are in Section 59A. Because this is a new tax, people are calling it, because the corporate alternative minimum tax, AMT, was repealed, people are considering this to be very similar, not similar in calculation, but a new tax to ensure that their corporations are paying some minimum level of tax. A number of jurisdictions around the world, the acronym for around the world is BEPS, which is base erosion and profit shifting. So the European countries already have a lot of these provisions in place, and a similar type of calculation will now be done and tax paid in the United States as well on that. So those are the three big provisions.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some of us here, again, were on conference calls, and the way the BEAT was explained was a corporate version of the AMT.
You can't say it's a one for one replacement, but yes.
Which is the alternative minimum tax. Okay, got it. Thank you.
Correct. So I think if we're not going to go into the other ones, that's all we had prepared today, Senator Haas.
Okay. Any questions of our CPAs?
No, hopefully we have more people testify.
We do not.
Do you want us to just explain what we put in the book? I don't know if you guys have even had a chance to look at it at all.
We have not. We don't have a copy of it.
Okay. Yeah. Because the part that Gary just went over is Section 2 in the five-section book, so that's just the whole Section 2 is over what he just covered. Section 1 is our normal reconnect kind of concept. We did it differently this year. It's high, medium, and low. High are the most important things. There are five basic things in there, which are the worldwide to territorial depreciation, the pass-through, state and local deduction, and the 529, all of which you're very aware of. Yeah. The medium section is kind of the middle ground, maybe you want to look at, but probably not, and low is really doesn't matter because it's corporate tax rates, which we have our own tax rates. Section 3 of the book covers the pass-through income deduction, which we talked about on Tuesday. Section 4 is the estate, Oregon estate tax, and how it is basically not affected by the federal change. And the fifth one, which Gary has kind of referred to, is the IRS is going to be issuing notices. There won't be laws done just due to timing.
Those books I always find helpful.
Mr. I actually do have a question.
Go ahead.
And obviously, there's a thousand rules why you can't answer this question, but that's okay. And everybody sitting behind you needs to put their iPads down and listen here, okay? So that they catch on to what's going on. At least the chair and I have been dealing with this for weeks and weeks and weeks. And in a whole variety of forums, we've reached out to a whole variety of entities, many of them represented sitting behind you. And two things have come that I have concluded from that. I'm paraphrasing for them so they understand they need to get up and move faster if I'm wrong here. And then sort of asking you the same question, and that is that, as you pointed out, some entities interpret this different. I have been in conversation with major entities in the state of Oregon. Some of them might even be your clients, and they have either one said, yes, this interpretation is possible, or two, yeah, we're not counting on that. And so my point here, and my point to the audience out there is at this point, every major entity that I have spoken to thinks it's mucked up and thinks they're going to do it the other way anyway and thinks you should just go fix this thing. Not one single C corporation has come to me and said, hey, you know, we think this is a great deal. Get the DRD, do all this sort of stuff out there. Not one. Nobody has said that to me. So that's the alert to everybody behind the scenes, because it's like, okay, it's mucked up. I guess my question to you, are you getting a lot of questions from your clients? Is it just, well, what do we do? Or a lot of them saying, hey, this looks like gravy train in Oregon, let's do this. Or is it just questions of not understanding it?
I think it's the former. I don't think many of our clients are saying this is a gravy train. I think most of our clients want to do the right thing and pay what the legislature deems to be appropriate. On the mucked up side, this is an extremely busy time for all of us as we try to get through these. There, you know, as I said, I deal with a multi-state basis, so all 50 states are trying to face this same exact thing and trying to come up with the same provisions. So, and none of them are uniform and similar. And that's why we've always testified in favor of connecting to the extent that a policy makes sense, is because it is right. So complicated for our clients, and our clients really do want to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Senator Brochier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I thought, what happened to the postcard? So kind of reading between the lines, if I was an accountant, I think I would be thinking, we're really not going to know until we go through a couple tax seasons how this is all going to shake out. Would that be a good observation?
That's a
very fair observation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, let me follow up.
Senator Boakley.
I fully agree with my colleague down here, and we're actually, before we get out of this reading room, we're all going to be on the same sheet of music, and it's likely to be two sides of the sheet of music, so I don't want to misconstrue this, but one of the problems specifically with the transition tax is, as well, we might be able to figure it out in the future. I agree with that. The fact of the matter is, the law says effective December 31st, you're doing it, corporation, and you're doing it in this tax year, and I'm guessing you have some smaller C corporations that are on a calendar year, and they got to figure this out between now and March 15th regardless, or they're going to be amending returns. Am I correct? Now, there are a lot of big people, which we've talked to, who their tax year ends in June or July, and they have the luxury of hiring 26 tax lawyers and 300 of you to figure this out.
You're correct. I mean, I don't know what the percentage would be of who's on what fiscal year right. They're on and what it would impact. I did mention earlier, you know, publicly traded companies have already had to face this issue.
Right.
To issue their financial statements, they've already had to come to reasonable basis opinions, and the accounting firms that audit them had to sign off on those positions already or are currently signing off as we speak.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I just want to reiterate, some of those entities that are in the state of Oregon that I have been in discussions with have chosen a path that says whatever we did in 2004, 2005, they don't care. They're going to try and live to the intent of the federal piece. I have not, again, everybody listening out there, not one C corporation has come to me and said, oh, yeah, you should do nothing. They've all said, we don't care what you do. We're going to do it the old way without this piece because we're just not going to spend the money to screw it, to muck with up. So I have seen, the only opposition I have seen to this, for the record, Mr. Chair, is what do you do? When do you do it? What do you do with the money? And do you make sure you connect with the our tax haven piece to integrate it? So that's what I've seen to date, but we're not ready for prime time.
We will be 4 hours from now.
Not necessarily, Mr. Chair.
Well, I will say from our firm standpoint, almost every business return that's going out the door right now, and even that has depreciation on it, because, again, that's a change, is getting a caveat that says this may have to be amended.
Well, and that wouldn't be rare. I mean, this is what we do, is update
exactly.
These changes all the time. Most of them are under the radar, but we do that all the time.
Exactly.
So thank you again, and I'm guessing we'll be seeing you again throughout even this short session, so thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
So I will close our public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 1529. My hope is to vote on 1528 and 1529 tomorrow, as early as tomorrow. Part of that depends on whether we get our technical changes done, Chris, throughout the day on these amendments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Chris Allen, Legislative Revenue, for the record. I just wanted to let you know that we have gotten two new amendments, technical fixes. The dash 8 for 1528 replaces the dash 7. That's the one I mentioned earlier.
Okay.
And on 1529, there is a dash 5 that replaces the dash 4. the Department of Revenue caught a technical glitch that we were able to get fixed within the past hour. So those amendments are out there.
Okay.
And they were, one with the 1528 was posted at about 8:30, and the 1529 amendment was posted just before 9 o'clock. So that has implications for timing of things tomorrow with a 24-hour notice.
Yep. Well, my hope is to get these through. I don't want to say rush through, but we have a short session. And I think already we've spent more time on Oregon fixes than the Congress did on the entire tax bill. So, but I don't want us to leave any of these behind. As you noted, that'd be a $100 million mistake for Oregon, and a similar problem on 1529. So, 1528. So, we'll try. We'll see what we can do. Okay. And you guys all know to find me or Chris on questions about any of these amendments or technical changes.
We'll look you up on Facebook.
Look me up on Facebook, and I'll like you.
I'll call you on my cell phone, Mr. Chair.
I don't think you will.
Because I don't own one.
We will adjourn.